Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the 343 podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today is going to be masterclass lesson number 8. Yes, indeed, there have already been 7 previous masterclass episodes, which I would encourage you all to go back and listen to. As a brief recap, we're simply discussing the topics that are brought up in the beginning stages of the premium masterclass program, which parents, you should, or I encourage you to go ahead and sign up for. It's at 343masterclass.com. Today's discussion is on the crucial importance of repetition. Now, repetition is something that everybody understands, and so it's very easy to think that it is a simple concept and we already get it. But like most all things, it's simple on the surface, but it gets a little bit more nuanced and complex the further down the rabbit hole you go. For example, not all repetition is good. If you're repeatedly doing the wrong things over and over and over again, well, guess what's going to happen to your neurons? Your neurons are going to ossify in bad habits, in doing the wrong things. Well, then, that begs the question, what are the right things to be repeating over and over again? Now, we talk a little bit about what those right things are in this episode, and so much more, of course, and we meander in and out of the topic per usual because, well, a lot of things are important. Speaking of repetition, coaches, if you want to learn the methodology that you should be repeating, the activities that you should be repeating with your teams, with your players, and frankly, for yourself, go to 343coaching.com. There are free and premium programs for you to enroll in there. And if you're coaching the little ones in the 7-versus-7 format, go to 7v7coaching.com. Parents, this series of masterclass episodes have been principally targeted at you, although coaches, of course, greatly benefit as well. If you like the premium membership for the masterclass, that is at 343masterclass.com. That is for you, parents. That is to enable you to better mentor and guide your youth player. All right, here we go. Enjoy this episode with Benny Rogers on repetition, among other things. Happy New Year, man. Happy New Year. Feliz Año Nuevo. This is a multilingual, multicultural podcast.
That's right. Do you have a good New Year's? Just low key?
Low key. We went to a nice dinner at a spot that we went once before and it did not fail. It was very good.
Where'd you go?
There's, oh God, what's it called? Arc something and winery or something.
Nice. What do they have, like steaks and stuff?
They got steaks, seafood, chicken. It's kind of unique in the sense that the kitchen is not behind any sort of wall. It's like right there in front of your face, the entire kitchen. They have a wood fire oven as well. And it's just like two guys hauling ass cooking everything. And, you know, we were wondering like, how are these guys doing this, man? Because the restaurant's not huge, but it's not small either. And the place was packed. And yet they're just whipping out the steaks, whipping out the poultry, whipping out the fish, whipping out the Brussels sprouts, whipping out the broccoli or whipping out the potatoes. And I'm like, damn.
Yeah. You know what's funny, Gary, is the next lesson we're chatting about is repetition is key, you know? So I'm sure that those guys have been doing it for 15 years and they just have it down to a science now.
No, and no joke, the topic came up while we're waiting and watching because we selectively chose a bar top, a bar stool, okay? And that's where you really get to see all the action, right? You can get a booth, you can get a table, but then you kind of miss all the whole show. And the topic came up and I'm like, well, and it's dark too, by the way, it's a dark spot. So they're kind of operating in the dark. So Irene's telling me like, how do they know when like the meat is done or when anything's done, you can't see anything. And I'm like, well, I don't know. If you've cooked the same steak 1,000 times, you know, you probably got that down and you've got the timing of everything down. So you're just like in a zone and you don't even have to think that much anymore. It's just a whip it out. Boom, 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 boom.
Yeah, just in flow. So as I was looking at the next topics that we could do, I noticed that we kind of started with some lessons that were in the middle, meaning that we already talked about the work ethic, sacrifice, and mentality one. And the other one, too, was technical debt. And I think that's come up a lot in our episode. So I figured repetition might be a good one to talk about today. Something that really stood out to me in the lesson, Gary, is how you kind of framed repetition, not really as a method, but kind of as the foundation of mastery. And not just for players, but also for coaches as well. And I don't know, it seems repetition, it seems so simple, but I think it's actually incredibly difficult to commit to it over the long term. Why do you think that is? Why do you think people struggle with embracing repetition, even though, you know, the formula for success is right in front of them? You know, it's, you look at the best athletes in the world or the people at the top of their profession, and the way that they got there is doing the basics thousands and thousands of times. So a quote that I always hear is, you know, don't practice until you get it right, but practice until you can't get it wrong. So I think that's something that it really shows why repetition is so beneficial. I don't know, I'll let you take it from there. I'll let you riff on that a little bit.
Yeah, two things come to mind. One is the word boring, and the other is marginal improvement. So number one, I think, is what everybody really understands, is that you do the same thing over and over and over again. You eventually get bored and you want to move on to something else. And I think it's, what's the word? Not deceitful. Let me see. It's kind of, it's something that we all struggle with, Ben, is the boredom. Okay. And when you are bored, then I think there's a natural instinct to believe that you're not making any progress with anything. And so every shiny new object attracts your attention. You're like, oh, I've already done this 1,000 times. It's boring. I kind of get it. And the key word there is kinda, right? I kind of get it. And then you go on and try to do another trick. And that is what's exciting, actually, because it's fresh, it's new, kind of like a new girlfriend, right? Stay with the girl for a very long time. You kind of get used to each other, and there's magic that's associated with that, obviously, but there's always this lingering thought in the back of your head. And it doesn't have to just be about relationships. It can be about absolutely anything at all. It could be about your job. It could be about the place you live in, anything, that the grass is greener on the other side. And so many of us fall prey to that. I'm myself included. You fall prey to the grass is probably greener, and you have FOMO, fear of missing out. What if I'm sticking with this for too damn long and I should be doing that over there? And guess what? You go and do that thing over there and then you leave this alone and never become a master at it. Well, forget master, because master for me is kind of, you've seen that documentary, Gyro Dreams of Sushi or something like that, where the guy is practicing how to make the rice for sushi for 10 years before he even is allowed to touch the fish, you know, before his father allows him to even touch the fish. So it reminds me of that a lot. And it's a big mistake, Ben. I think that's the word that I was looking for earlier. It's a big mistake to abandon the boring task. Now, the key is something we harped on last episode about hopefully having a mentor, and it doesn't or mentors, and it doesn't have to be somebody in person necessarily. It could be a digital mentor. It could be somebody that you have identified or has been identified as a master in their craft or somebody extremely knowledgeable. And you're following their instructions so that you know which tasks you should be bored with and continue doing them versus which activities you should abandon and go somewhere else. I'll give you an example. If you are juggling, right, and then you get bored of juggling and you want to move on instead to using the wall and practicing receiving across the body, well, a good mentor would be like, fuck yeah, abandon that juggling shit and allocate way more time to receiving across the body from the wall, as opposed to somebody who may be online or maybe in person who is not a good mentor because they don't really know the material, might say, nah, keep juggling, man. Don't quit. Even if you're bored, keep doing the juggling thing. And then that's a mistake, clearly. So the mentorship is very important. The second thing, Ben, that came to mind as to why people abandon it, which is related, of course, is this whole idea of only seeing marginal improvement. When you start something new and you're completely incompetent, you see improvement really fast. Okay, maybe a person doesn't know how to do a bicycle kick, and maybe after a week they can actually make contact with the ball. That is a huge leap in improvement, so that you get this dopamine high and you continue wanting to do that for a while. But after you've kind of made contact with the ball, and after you've made contact with the ball and you can get it on target, you know, what's the next step? The next step might be actually being able to place it when doing a bicycle kick, actually wanting to go bottom left corner of the goal. Well, really fucking hard, you know, and people will kind of give up on that and say, yeah, I can make contact. I can get it on target. That's all I need. And I move on to something else. Now, I don't know why the bicycle kick came to mind, because that's completely impractical. And guys, don't go and practice bicycle kicks. And that was a stupid example. But it's just to make the point of marginal improvement. So you move on to something else instead of getting that last 10% better, or that last 5% better, or that last 3% better. And for professional soccer players, or people who get to be a professional or want to be a professional, it's that last 10, 5, 2, 1%, half of a percent that makes all the difference in the world.
I see what you're saying, Gary. And I think the importance of having a mentor is huge, because especially for younger players, it's like, how do you know at what point you should be moving on? How can you determine that? Well, let's say a kid out there doesn't have a mentor. When do they feel like they would be able to move on? Do they have to just have that feeling like, all right, let's say you're working on like a outside of the foot curler shot, right? Is it they're hitting it 10 times out of 10 times and now they can move on to the next thing? Or is it just more of like a feel like, all right, I'm ready to move on?
Yeah,
it's
a good question.
Part of not having a mentor, right?
Yeah, it's a good question. Could spend entire episodes, plural, on this one. I'm going to say one thing that came to my mind, and that is sometimes the real world can be a great mentor. Meaning, you're talking about youth players. Let's say, first off, it's age dependent, but let's say that you're a youth player and you have this question in your mind and you're playing games and you're not the best on your team and you see what the best player or players on the team are able to do and you're not able to do. Well, that's the real world mentor right there. So if the best player on the team is able to, I don't know, dribble by a guy in a certain fashion and then slot it bottom right corner of the goal, and you're like, man, I wish I could do that. And you're not able to do that. Well, you better keep training that until you're able to do it. So I don't know. That's what came to mind, Ben, is the real world mentor. The pitfall with that is that you might be admiring things that are not high return on investment. For instance, that example I just gave you might not be high ROI if you're a center back, right? And you admire the guy doing that sort of thing. That's just an extreme silly example. But again, to make the point of the real world is a good mentor, but you kind of need a human being that's been there, done that, very experienced to kind of guide you as well. And hopefully, I mean, you're very lucky if you have a parent that can be that person. But unfortunately, most kids don't have former professional soccer player parents or former high level soccer people as parents.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't know if you remember when I told you about, you know, the hero of my youth team, the kid that could launch it, you know, but this one would, you know, if it's a free kick 20 yards out, this one could, you know, launch it over the goal or even like hit the crossbar. And for me as a little shrimp, I was never able to hit the crossbar. So I was like, what the fuck? Like, and I would spend like hours, you know, after practice, just trying to get the ball up in the air. And I remember, Gary, like the first time I ever hit the ball over the goal, I was like, oh, I did it. This is great. And then I never practiced it again, you know? So it's like, yeah, I see what you're saying. And if I didn't have, well, at the time, I didn't have somebody to tell me like, all right, Benny, maybe you shouldn't be focusing on just hitting the ball over the crossbar. But
yeah,
I see what you're saying there.
Yeah. No, the term I was looking for, I think earlier, is diminishing returns. So you get a lot of return in the very beginning, and then the better and better you get at something, the more you do it, the returns on your time investment get smaller and smaller and smaller. And that's what discourages a lot of people, and they abandon the exercise, even though it may be the wrong thing to do. And coaches fall prey to this all the time, especially new coaches. And by new coach, you could have been coaching 6 years and I could consider you new for sure. They just abandon activities or methodologies that are kind of like the golden ticket and the right thing to do too soon. And it happens all the time with rondos. I know people are sick and tired of listening to the 343 podcast and coming across that term rondo, but it's so crucial. And coach is like, I do rondos, or I did it. And they move on to the latest and greatest jargon in football. Huge mistake for themselves, not just the players.
Yeah, there's actually a whole lesson in the coaching course that it's titled A Huge Mistake Well-Meaning Coaches Are Making, right? And that's what you mentioned, that they just move on from one exercise to the other without creating any consistency. And the hard part is, Gary, especially now with like Instagram and X, you come across all these different drills like, oh, Pep Guardiola, Man City drill, or Atletico Madrid, and they have all these diagrams. And for a new young coach, they could be like, oh, wow, this seems fantastic. I'm going to run this session tonight with my team. And, you know, they're not sticking to, the players aren't grasping any material because they're not getting any repetition. It's a different thing every single week. So that's the hard part, especially for new coaches, that maybe don't have much experience out there.
Totally. I recently came across, I'm sure you've seen it, the Borussia Dortmund technology thing where it came out maybe like 10 years ago, where they place a player like in this room and they're surrounded by little openings all around the perimeter that light up at particular moments in time. So a ball will be served into them and they have to quickly identify which doorway kind of lit up green. And that's where they have to execute their next pass ASAP, as fast as possible. So they're inside this sort of room for, you know, an extended period of time, receiving balls, identifying where the green door is and dishing the pass, you know. And I don't know the timing of when they do the green lighting up as such, but I know that coaches, when it came out, saw this thing like, oh, that's so cool. Obviously, I can't afford that or I can't build that thing, but, you know, I'm going to make up something just like that, you know. And for example, they'll create a circle of players and each player has like a green flag or something, you know, and then they'll put a player in the middle and they'll kind of try to replicate the drill. And that's cool if you're having a little bit of fun at times, but no, they're trying to legit be innovators and like, oh, this is going to develop my player, you know, let's go for this. Instead of sticking to the 1,000-year-old fundamental principles that are, I was going to say well-known, but I guess they're not well-known, especially not here in the United States. Stick to the core shit, man. Stop trying to invent stuff, especially when you yourself haven't even reached a level of competence or expertise in coaching. You can sense a little bit of frustration in my voice because at times I am a little frustrated. I think there's a lot of folks out there who are well-meaning and taking coaches on a wild goose chase and recommending things that shouldn't be done and recommending things that they themselves who are the recommenders. I don't want to go down this negativity. 2025, let's keep it positive, man.
Well, Gary, I might have been guilty of that I know exactly which thing you're talking about. And you're right. I actually set up like 4 pug goals, you know, and I would just, I would just number the pugs so they shoot it in 1.
Yeah.
So, hey, sick activity though.
But I get it. I totally get it, man. And it happens in so many ventures. Like when I first started programming or when I first started being an engineer, when I first started getting some competence in physics, you start getting this false sense of your capabilities and your knowledge. I think it's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. Maybe you can look that up and put a little screenshot of Dunning-Kruger effect. I don't know. Where you learn just a little bit and you actually think you're an expert already and you're like, okay, I'm going to start innovating. And I would do it too, Ben. I would do it too. I'm like, oh, I'm going to re-architect this whole way of writing code. I can't believe when I reflect back, I'm like, I thought I was at that level to do something like that. Or, oh, nobody's able to solve the 3-body problem in physics. You know what? I'm going to take a stab at it. Fucking hilarious, Ben.
Yeah, I have it right here, Gary. It's in psychology, a cognitive bias whereby people with limited knowledge or competence in a given intellectual or social domain greatly overestimate their own knowledge or competence in that domain relative to the objective criteria or to the performance of their peers or people in general.
Yeah, it's littered, bro. American soccer is littered with that situation. And guys, not just coaches. I mean, the worst offenders, I think, are the media and critics. The war absolute worst offenders. Oh, so ridiculous that Fabio Conceição, you know, who's now taking over AC Milan, is thinking of making this, you know, getting this guy and this guy and getting rid of this guy. As if you know what the fuck you're talking about because you've been watching AC Milan and Christian Pulisic for a season. Get out of my fucking face.
I think, Gary, if you look at like the most successful soccer programs out there, football programs, meaning like the Barca's, Bayern Munich, the Ajax, the thing that they all have in common is from U8, the repetition of the fundamentals, meaning that from U8 all the way until the first team, they are doing rondos every single activity and not going from one thing to the next. And it's no surprise why they develop some of the best players in the world.
Yeah, there's a lot of critics about the methodology too. Oh, you're eliminating their creativity. But we've covered that in other episodes. Folks can go back to the previous masterclass lessons that we've recorded here. I think this is number 8, maybe, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's number 8. So we've recorded masterclass lessons 1 through 7 previously. I would encourage folks who haven't done so, go back. And we talk a lot about this creativity versus structured sort of debate. And no, I'll give you the TLDR. No. doing this stuff is not eliminating the creativity of the players. Okay. What is eliminating the creativity of the players is actually not going out into the pickup environment or the environment outside of the club and actually playing.
And yeah, we talked about it, right? Like mastering these fundamentals allows players in game to be able to focus more on what is important, meaning that like when the ball is coming to them, they're not thinking like, all right, I need to place my foot here or I need to have this way to pass. Like, it's just natural. Like, I remember as the player for Brian, something that, you know, or analogy that he uses is like, for example, when you first start brushing your teeth, right? When you're a little kid, like you're, okay, you're thinking about putting the toothpaste on and like the movement of the brushing. And over time, now you don't even think about it anymore. It's just second nature to you. So that analogy always stuck with me from Brian.
Yeah. It makes sense, man. And finally, we're 20 minutes into the episode and we're getting to the meat of it all is what does repetition do for you in a more practical sense, which is, hey, if you reach a certain level of mastery with doing a particular type of thing, let's say receiving across the body, which is the proper way to receive a football 99.9% of the time, when you're in a game situation as a player, in the beginning, you have to think about it. You have to reorient your body. You have to say, okay, here it comes. Let me stick my leg out like this. Okay, here, don't stiffen your leg too much. You know, otherwise it's going to ricochet off you. You think about the mechanics of it all. And then after all the repetition years, you don't think about it anymore. Yeah, complete automation. And that releases brain cycle energy for you to be thinking about what is my next action or my next two actions going to be. You don't have to focus on the receiving the ball at all. And the same thing with finishing, Ben. I mean, there's a reason that Ronaldo and Haaland and all these guys are so world-class at finishing is they've done it so much that they don't really get excited. Oh my God, I'm going to get a shot on goal. Oh my God. And you hit it right. Hit it on target. Hit it correct. No, it's just complete automation. And automation with respect to knowing where the keeper is, automation, knowing where how the keeper is leaning, automation is feeling your surroundings. They're not thinking about, oh, the keeper's there, I'm going to slot it here. It's just automatic. Your brain knows.
I think for strikers and attacking players, Gary, it's a little bit more obvious as to kind of what reps that they should be getting. In terms of defenders, like center backs, outside backs, what do you think their repetition should look like when they're training on their own?
Got it. Well, there's the offensive part and then there's the defensive part. Let me come up with just a couple of things, otherwise we'll be here all day long. On the in possession part, something that's very valuable, let's say a center back or even an outside back, let's say a center back, because they don't get much love in football, is doing disguised passes, right? So if you want to be able to get the ball to your center mids, for instance, it's kind of hard because sometimes there's a lot of defenders obstructing your line of sight or the path. And so what you do is you pivot your body and face maybe your left back or your right back as if you're going to give it to them. And then that's why it's called the disguised pass. You whip your leg around and you filter a ball on the ground to your central midfielders. Now that takes a lot of practice because you kind of have to, it's almost like a no-look pass. And you kind of have to keep track of the defender and the path of the pass and your buddy there out of the corner of your eye. So if you do that over and over and over and over and over again and repeat it over and over again, it comes naturally, Ben. And I just know this because I've been doing it all my life too, the disguise pass. To a world-class level? No, but I know what it is. I know what it feels like. And I know what it feels like when you don't have to think about it anymore. That's why that one came to mind. And from a defensive perspective, this might be a little bit more difficult if we're sticking with the center back position. The one that comes to mind is requires you to be with somebody else to practice it. Maybe not. I haven't thought of an activity where you can do it alone. But it's when there's a ball in the air and you're going to have to challenge for the ball in the air, which happens 1,000 times a game for center backs. Okay. There's an art to this where first you have to know where the ball is going to land. And that takes a lot of repetitions. Okay. So that your brain gets used to pattern matching and being able to say, okay, I see the ball just got launched. I know it's going to land right here on the ground. That takes a while to really understand. And then number two, when you're going to be challenging, get to the position first. And then when the other guy gets there to challenge you, know how to give him a certain type of nudge or push or hip check right before you're both going to go above to unbalance the other guy. That is an art, Ben, and that requires a shit ton of repetitions. And I think it's important for those listening out there, if you have a kid who is a center back, or you are a center back, or you're scouting center backs, to just look at pro games and study how they do it, how the best in the world do it. It's a thing to behold, man.
Yeah. And so people don't get the wrong idea. I mean, you're referring to the ball's in the air and you give them a little nudge, but without fouling.
Correct. Of course. Yeah. No. Without fouling. Absolutely. Because you're allowed to make contact with the other player. Obviously, when you've seen many challenges, they're making contact all the time. How do you make that contact? And at what time do you make that contact?
Yeah. Yeah. And Gary, a lot of coaches, even fans and parents, they underestimate, you know, the passing ability of a center back. You know, for especially if you're playing in a possession-based system, you need your center backs to be comfortable on the ball, be able to spray passes, line breaking passes. And it's an art that gets overlooked a lot, you know, because somebody thinks about a center back, they just immediately, what comes to mind to them is their defensive qualities, meaning their 1v1 defending ability, their speed, their ability to, you know, make challenges in the air. But on the ball in possession, it's critical. And this is what I always tell any defender. It's like, if you guys lose the ball, we're fucked, right? Because if you're the nine, if you're a winger, you can lose the ball up top with zero consequence. But as a center back or outside back, you lose the ball, the other team's going straight to goal, you know? So the ability to complete passes and be comfortable on the ball, that's huge for defenders. And I think that gets overlooked.
Absolutely critical and spot on, Ben. So with that in mind, how about I give another example here for the center back that's crucial for them, especially in a possession-based system, and especially which means, especially if you aspire to be on the best teams, okay? Or get the furthest or to the highest level possible. And that's the diagonal ball. So if you're a left center back, be able to ping a 40 to 50 yard ball to your right winger. If you're a right center back, be able to ping a 40 or 50 yard ball to your left winger, you know, over the top and various strokes. But the most predominant one is like a backspin sort of stroke, mid height, so that it gets there fast, right? And on target and in stride for the wingers. Absolutely crucial and absolutely devastating to the opponent, because usually you're attacking the weak side at that point. Again, I repeat, if you're a right center back, the entire opponent is shifted to the right, okay, preponderance of the time, and the left winger is kind of isolated, either completely alone or they will be left 1v1 alone, which is what you want, yeah? So to be able to deliver that ball to the left winger is a skill that is so underrated here in American soccer that if you're capable of doing it, you'll differentiate yourself. But repetition, right, Ben? You have to be able to, since you're 10 years old, or if you're starting late, fine, start late. If you're 14, it's not too late. Start pinging those balls over and over and over and over again. And speaking of repetition, it's kind of hard here as well. We talked about finding field space, but I think if you really want it, you can do it. You can find field space to do this. I live close by to the great parks here in Irvine. You know how much field space there is? And if you're not going to show up with a whole bunch of people to play a game, they're not going to kick you out if you're a lone guy there with a bag of balls, just pinging balls. You're going to be left alone. The park ranger isn't going to come out around and kick you out.
Yeah. And I think it's important, Gary, to mention like meaningful repetition, because I can remember as a kid, okay, I was working on, let's say I was working on just long distance passing, but I had no idea like the different types of passes, meaning a daisy cutter pass or a hard driven ball. Like the only thing I was focused on as a kid was getting the ball in the air. Like if I got the ball in the air, it was like a huge success. And it wasn't until I got to Brian's team when he showed us like, okay, this is the different types of balls that you can play. This is a backspin ball. This is exactly how you hit it. So especially if you're a center back or outside back and you're working on those types of passes, you need to make sure that you have intention with it. Meaning like, all right now I'm going to work on a daisy cutter. Right now I'm working on a driven ball that's not going to get picked off by the team's opposing six. So making sure that you know what it is that you're working on and getting meaningful reps,
yeah,
is huge.
So the example we just talked about, 40, 50 yard passes, it's kind of important to have a passing partner so that you get a ton of repetitions. You don't have to go be fetching balls and you have a target in place and a legit target. Outside of that, you can still do it. Maybe your target is the goal. Okay. You're not trying to score, but that is your target. You want to actually get the ball there. Or the wall, obviously, is the other one. But I understand it's challenging. You just have to do it, because if you don't do it, your competitors are doing it. And guess what? At the end of the day, they're going to get far and you're not going to get far. But hey, you know what's interesting, Ben? Because we're speaking of mentors too. How do you deliver that ball? You know, what does it actually look like? And I think, look, the parents are trying to do the best they can and coaches are trying to do the best they can. I get it. But I think so many are bogged down and saying, no, place your left foot here, you know, before you hit the ball, and angle your body like this, and then make contact right here with your striking foot. They try to break it down like that, and kids don't learn that way, okay? Kids learn, the most effective way of learning, in my opinion, is watching people actually hit the ball and then trying to mimic how they're doing it. And instead of being told, lock your ankle, do this, do that. Nah, it's going to take experimentation in the beginning, but watch the guys who are actually doing it correctly and you yourself trying to mimic it, if that makes sense. Ben, does that make sense? Do you know what I'm talking about?
100%, Gary. And like I just gave the example of, right, Brian teaching us the backspin ball. Like mm-hmm. He did tell us, like, all right, like this is technique, but then he demonstrated it like 10 times in front of us and we were able to learn that way, you know. And it's funny how, like, so there's some moments that you remember vividly as a kid. And anytime I'm playing, like, pick up now or 11v11, I don't even think about it anymore. I know how to do it now, you know.
And the first time it comes off correctly, you're like, oh my God, yes. It's an amazing feeling.
Fucking incredible.
Look, I'm going to plug it because I think it's important. We're trying to help people as well. And yes, it is a business, but we're trying to help. The masterclass has a whole bunch of videos for different types of strokes. So you can just play the video of the stroke being executed properly and just put it on a loop and watch it as many times as you need to watch it until you get it right. And then revisit it. If you still can't do it, revisit the video, put it on a loop and keep looking. Eventually your neurons are going to get it.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, Gary, I mean, we're living in a world where so much information is available to us. And you have talked about many times how you and Brian would have the VHS and be pausing and rewinding, but now you can literally go on YouTube, and if there's a skill that you want to learn or like a player who does something consistently, you want to do it, it's right there for you to access. You know what I'm saying? So, but it's what I like about, you know, the lessons in the masterclass is it's the actual players doing it, but also they're talking about how they're doing it and breaking it down to a science kind of.
Yeah, no, and it's application to the real world, to the real game, because you might see a whole bunch of skill stuff online. You're like, okay, I want to do that. And you practice it and you do the layout, the cones, and you do this sort of stuff. But how often does it happen in a game? And is it practical? How many times are you going to actually do that move that is being taught to you? Is it a fundamental move? Is it something foundational? Because the most important thing, Ben, is to get the foundation right, is to get the principles, the stuff that never changes ever in football, ever. That is what you really need. That is the core. And once you get really good at all those fundamentals, all that core, then fine. Go and practice your silly tricks or your cone dribbling maneuvers and finishing maneuvers that might happen once in your entire season. Okay, cool. Go do that.
What would you say are like the five most fundamental things that happen in any given game?
Well,
that a player should master.
Well, if we're talking about in possession, because right, there's the different phases. And I like to talk about in possession versus defense, because defense, there's a very famous quote. I think it's, is it from Bielsa? I don't remember. Maybe it's older school than Bielsa, but that coaches can teach anybody to defend. For the most part, they get them up to 90%, let's say, because 90% of defending is run, motherfucker, run. Okay. It's the other side of the equation in possession. That's very difficult to learn and you just can't get to 90% that easily. So being in possession, I think receiving across the body correctly is foundational. If you don't have that, just throw everything out the window. You're not going far. Let's see. Passing with the inside of the foot obviously is very foundational, okay, at different distances and to the correct foot of your teammate. So be able to do it 10 yards, 20 yards, 30 yards, hell, maybe even a 40's pushing it. You kind of have to go in the air at that point. But up to 30 yards, let's say, on the ground, inside of the foot is crucial. Your first touch, of course, in all scenarios is crucial, but that again brings us back to receiving across your body, but sometimes the ball's not on the ground. So you're not going to be receiving it necessarily across the body the way that is most foundational. So first touch, crucial. So those are three. Long range passes, I think, are crucial. All kinds of strokes, low range, you know, knee height, maybe 10 feet high. And then obviously the long, long ones, which could be 30 feet high in the air. And then I need one more, right, Ben? I'm going off the cuff here. I was going to say finishing, but, you know, if you're a center back, you ain't finishing very often.
Let me add one in, Gary, because I think it's something that gets overlooked. And it was instilled in me from Brian is, you know, the ability to scan your shoulder or, you know, look behind you so that you can see what's coming in. It seems so simple, Gary, but actually, like, when you get into the game, if you haven't had a repetition on it, it's like it's unnatural for you to be like going like that all the time. And if you're not constantly working on that in training and getting reps on it, I mean, it's fundamental, right? The highest level players are always scanning their shoulders, but maybe people wouldn't consider that as a fundamental just because they don't know.
No, it is. It is absolutely critical and crucial. You're going nowhere without that. I was just focusing on the in possession sort of technique sort of thing, right? But 100% is if you don't scan, and there's different levels of scanning, obviously. I think this is what people miss. There's the level one scanning is kind of, I think, what you describe, which is checking your shoulder to see if you have somebody on you, okay?
Right.
To understand what kind of pressure you're under. That's level one. And I think that's what most people do, most players do. Level two is you're doing that, but also acquiring the information of where are your teammates? So what is going to be your next offensive action with respect to progressing the ball forward? Who are you going to give it to? Or are you going to keep it yourself? So you're scanning not just for your opponent, you're scanning as to what does the map of the field look like with respect to your own teammates. And then I think level three takes that a step further, and you're not just thinking about your next pass. You're taking the map of the field and you're like, okay, what are the next two actions that are going to happen after I get rid of the ball? What can we do? So I'll give you an example. Let's say you're center mid because the center mid needs this skill more than anybody else on the field because they are surrounded, right? You need a 360 map. If you're a center mid and let's say you might receive a pass, okay, soon from your outside back. So you start scanning. You're like, oh my God, if I get it now, my left winger is completely isolated. And if I get it, if I receive, turn and give it to him in two touches, okay, my next action after that is kind of launching the counterattack. Like I'm running forward and I'm going to tell everybody to let's go on the counter sort of thing. So that's kind of like level three thinking. You're scanning, see if you have pressure. You're scanning, taking a map of the field. And level three is, okay, after I've made that decision as to what I'm going to do, what is the next one that I'm going to do?
How do you get to level three, Gary? Because in theory, it sounds, I feel like somebody that's listening to this could be like, all right, like I'm going to do that in my next game. But you know what I'm saying? It's not easy to do.
You get to level three, Ben, first and foremost, by having the foundational techniques in order, a level of expertise and mastery with receiving the ball. Because if you don't have a good first touch and you don't receive it the right way to set yourself up with the next pass, naturally, without thinking, and you're able to execute it 99.9% of the time, if you don't have that technique down, you're wasting your time thinking, oh my God, I'm going to do this and that and the other thing. It's all going to fall to pieces for you because as soon as you sense any type of pressure whatsoever, you're not going to be able to execute. So why even get to level two or level three? You're still trying to focus on, oh shit, here comes the ball. I don't want to lose it. So you need the technique first.
It sounds like me in high school, Greg.
You're panicking, right?
Panic mode.
Well, you see it. And I think this is so valuable for scouts. And I think so valuable for people observing soccer games, whether you be a parent or a coach or a fan, is stop looking at the ball, first and foremost. Look at maybe who is going to receive the ball next. You're a spectator now. Look at who is going to receive the ball next. And look at their demeanor, their body posture, their positioning. You eventually get to the point where you realize whether they're hiding and they don't want it. So clearly they're fearful. And if they're fearful, then that means they're clearly not confident in their technique, okay? And that tells you a lot. right there and then. It tells you whether, oh, this kid is what ready for the next level, not ready for the next level at all. You don't even have to see the player actually receive. You get all this other sort of information. And even if a player might be the star of their team and really good, you still get these cues. It's really cool. I don't know, when Brian and I would go and scout and take a look, you get these cues from so many players who are like youth national team players or really highly rated players. Or, you know, I was told, oh, go check this player out. Gary, he's baller, amazing. You guys should get him for your youth team or something. And I go, and there's all these cues that the typical person doesn't pick up on. I don't know if any of that made any sense, Benny. And maybe that player, when I went to see him, scored two goals and mean-ass goals or whatever, free kick goal or whatever. But you get all this other information that's not easily accessible.
So the cues would come mainly from like off the ball stuff and like body language type things.
Yeah,
that's where you would see the most.
Yep. There's players who hide. They don't want it for whatever reason. You just reminded me because you told me that was you, that you were shitting your pants when you were receiving a ball in high school.
Right.
But I get it. And I know that feeling too, Benny, because I've played against teams, you know, growing up who are way better, or players who are way better. And I'm like, oh shit, here, fuck, don't fuck it up, Gary. Here, you're finally getting the ball. You get that sense of anxiety for sure.
Yeah.
I bet it probably never ends. You know, let's say you're amazing player. Okay. Let's say, or a really good player. Let's say you're Ricky Pooch. Okay. Not world class, nothing incredibly amazing, but you're a good player. You were trained at FC Barcelona. You rose the ranks. You eventually got your opportunity with the first team even. Imagine you're that guy and you're getting your debut with the first team Barcelona. You have to take advantage of your opportunity. Otherwise, you may never sniff the field again. And you're stepping on the field and you've got Messi and you've got Neymar and you've got Luis Suarez and you've got all these super phenom cracks surrounding you. There's got to be a bit of that in you, even though you've been the best player on your youth teams all the way growing up. You're like, oh shit, Messi just gave me the ball. Don't fuck it up.
And then he made his big move to the LA Galaxy.
Oh, Ben. I mean, every player's got their trajectory. Every player eventually finds their level, in my opinion. And yeah, okay. Good for him. He's making good money. Can't blame him.
What position did you play, Gary?
Center mid, dude. The 10, almost always. And then as I got older, the 6. Yes. And as I got older, still center back. After I was retired, is center back. Center back or striker? Because I don't have to run very much. And I can punish you as a striker. And as a center back, I'm just, you know how I am, super vocal and just ordering people, bossing people around in front of me.
You're a savage when you play, but in a good way.
And man, it got really bad, dude. Once my knee kind of messed up, and everybody talks about this, oh, I blew out my knee. You know, it's a classic. I'm telling you, once I started having a little bit of a knee problem, I just started playing scared. You know, even receiving a ball with my right foot, and you know, obviously you have to plant your left foot to receive it and make a jerky movement if somebody's coming at you, your brain just starts playing tricks on you and you're not confident. And then your first touch is off and it's a fucking disaster. So my fall was fucking fast, Benny. It was like a disaster.
I thought you were going to say the opposite, meaning like when your body slowed down, you started making smarter decisions, like one or two touches or... Because if you see like old guys who used to be really good and you see them in games, like they don't run much, but when the ball comes to them, it's just simple, one and two touch, but you know, smart players still.
Well, yeah, for sure. And that's kind of how you get your excitement, is just being able to cleanly execute your pass. That's all. That's how you get your excitement, because the body just doesn't work, Ben. You can't juke anybody anymore.
Yeah. So Gary, we talked a lot about like what types of repetitions should players be getting, but what about coaches? Should they be getting reps at something? Should they be working on at like their pregame speech in the mirror before the game? You know what I'm saying? What types of repetitions can coaches get?
There's a lot, man. There's a lot. I will say, before you start practicing your halftime speeches in the mirror, get really good at coaching the fundamental activities, because that will make your players better. That will make your team better. and that will make you feel better and gain confidence as a coach also, because if you're doing those things, guess what? You're going to start winning some games also. And guess what? You're not just going to be winning games by kicking them up to the man child. You're going to start winning some games by playing good football. And then you start getting buy-in from all the players, and you get buy-in from the parents, and you get buy-in from the club. And then your confidence is through the roof at that point, which then enables all these other things, like maybe practicing pregame speeches. I've never done that, Benny. Practice a halftime speech in the mirror. Maybe you can tell a story about that, Benny. But you get what I'm saying. Like, I recommend, just like players, get the fundamental principles down. Get the coaching methodology down with the proper exercises. Again, 343coaching.com is where you want to go for this. And then the rest of it comes along for the ride, man.
Yeah. No, I'd imagine, Gary, like the top coaches in the world, obviously before they have their pregame chats or, you know, pregame meeting the night before, they're going over in their head what they're going to say and how they want to come across. So that's what I was referring to.
Yeah, no, 100%, Ben. I was just trying to crack a joke, but you do study. You study, man. You study off of the field when you're at home, when you're in the shower, when you're game planning your training session, when you're game planning for the game itself on the weekend. You study. You study all your players. You study your opponent, and you come up with a game plan that you yourself believe that you're not that you're just making shit up, you know, just to be able to have something to say. No, you yourself believe it. And since you've studied, you don't then have to practice it in the mirror. It's just going to come out naturally to your players in pregame or in training or at halftime. This is the game plan. This is how we're going to execute it. Mark, these are your responsibilities. Chris, this is what you should be doing. And Beto, you know, you just do what you do and dribble by five people and score. But yeah, you can't study and prepare if you don't have the foundations in the first place, is my opinion.
For parents, Gary, is there any types of repetitions that they can be getting? I feel like watching high level games on TV is a good way to be able to help their kids to know what to look for and to give them meaningful comments after a game versus like, oh, you suck today, or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, it's a good question. It's tough because if one just says, oh, watch a bunch of games, again, they're going to struggle with not having a mentor telling them what the heck are they watching in the first place. So for them to get on the learning curve and get good enough for them to give good advice to their kids is going to take them 10 years if they're just by themselves. And even after 10 years, you might have learned the wrong things or listened to the wrong broadcasters or read the wrong media. You might be giving shockingly bad advice even after 10 years. And in the rare instance where you learned all the right things, and you've become very extremely competent, well, now it's 10 years later, your kid's 19 or 20 years old, it's over at that point. So you kind of need mentors telling you, hey, these are the important things to be observing if you're going to raise your soccer IQ by watching games. And it's a tough challenge, Ben. It's really difficult, man, which is why we try to build the master class, but it's very, very tough. And there's a lot of years worth of time savings if you were to go into the master class already, but there's a lot of room for improvement from our end on to hone in on how to accelerate or jam pack 10 years of or 20 or 30 years of knowledge and expertise into a 1-year program or a 2-year program so that the parent who picks it up within 2 years, oh man, they can totally guide and mentor their kid. That is the goal. That is the challenge. We still have a ways to go. But imagine if you have no mentors, Ben, you're in big trouble. You're screwed. Think of your parents, Benny. I love your parents. They can't guide you or mentor you in football and soccer, right? And you had three brothers and they went through the entire trajectory with all the brothers. Do they know something about soccer, the parents? Of course. But could they have mentored you to be a pro or to be, you know, something of that level? There's no chance. No way, dude.
My dad will be like, I played in high school, but this book is shocking when he kicked the ball.
Was he toe poking?
For the most part.
Oh, man. So I don't know. I'm sorry. I feel bad for ranting, but.
No, it's good.
Yeah. It's a tough problem, dude. And if it weren't a tough problem, I wouldn't be interested, to be frank.
For parents who want to help their kids? What's the best way that they can support their kids getting meaningful repetition without kind of overstepping or burning out the kids? Because I think if a parent is the one telling the kid, like, hey, we're going to go to the wall today, you're going to get 1,000 touches on the wall, I think the kid can easily get burned out, you know? So what's the best way that they can support their kids in repetition?
So tough. I think maybe, and I don't know the answer. I'll start off with that. Okay. I don't know. But I think probably talking to them in an encouraging way. Well, first, the kid has to love it. If they love it and they're always want, oh, give me the Messi jersey. Oh, let's, you know, watch soccer. Oh, I want to play more, you know, take me to indoor soccer games or leagues or whatever. Obviously, nurture that. Obviously, support that. But if you have a kid that's that enthusiastic, I think the best thing a parent can do is work on the mentality side of the equation. Don't necessarily tell them or take them to the park. Oh, here's the wall. Do 1,000 reps just like the masterclass told us to do. No, I think that's not the best thing to do. The best thing to do is work on their mentality. Tell them, oh, okay, you want to be a pro one day, or you want to play Division I soccer, or you want to eventually get to, you know, play ECNL or MLS next, or eventually want to be on youth national team or something of this nature. Oh, okay, cool, Johnny. Awesome. And then from that point forward, kind of try to indoctrinate your kid to have the strong mentality that's going to take to get there.
Yeah.
Don't fucking clap, you know, when it's an eighth place finish, you know, and say, oh, here's a trophy.
Promotion relegation.
Well, yeah, man, there's promotion relegation in life, my friend. Guess what? The genes that survive create the species that survive. So if you're most fit for your environment, you're capable of escaping the lions. And if you're not fit, lions are going to eat you and your bloodline is lost. So the fittest survive and are promoted, and the others relegated to irrelevance and non-existence.
Yeah, for sure. And to me, Gary, it seems like the kids who love the game the most come from families where, like, the parents are the ones that also love the game, meaning like the dad was always watching soccer when the kid was a baby. And then as a kid, he's still watching, and the kids kind of just want to be like their mom or their dad, and they love the game. Like, I was at Downtown Disney, like, I don't know, like 2 or 3 months ago, and there's like a little live music stage, but also like an area for like kids to run around, right? And all the kids are running around, fucking going crazy. But then there's these two Hispanic kids, like in the middle of like 60 kids running around. These fools are passing it to each other, like trying to score goals or dribbling around the other kids that are, you know, going crazy. And you could just tell, like, it's not like their parents are telling them, like, oh, like, go train right there. But no, these kids just love the game. And when any chance that they have to touch the ball, they're going to do it.
Culture matters, Ben.
We could do I think we have done a whole episode on culture now, or you have done a whole episode on.
I don't even remember. Culture. I don't even remember anymore. Sometimes, you know what's weird? Sometimes I listen to these episodes when maybe doing a little final tweak or doing the introduction or something. Like, I think back and I can't remember if we covered these sorts of topics historically or not, because if everything seems so new and fresh. I'm sure we have. I'm sure we've talked about culture a million times. Have we done a specific episode only on culture? I don't remember. But culture matters a lot.
Oh, these topics are evergreen, and, you know, they're always going to be relevant, no matter if they were recorded 10, 15, 20 years ago. You know, these episodes have significance.
And guess what? How culture develops? Repetition. You do this, you know, you do the same things every day, the same cultural things every day, whether it's your family cooks dinner every night and everybody sits together every single night. That's a culture building exercise if you do it every night. If you only do it once a month, then that's not in your cabinet, you know, of things to do. If your dad's an engineer or scientist and your mom's technical also, guess what? Growing up, the kid is going to be hearing a lot of math and going to be getting a lot of good math and science sort of tutoring at home in many respects. And that's culture building. And the kid is going to grow up to not be fearful and be able to do the math stuff and the science stuff. And there's a pretty good probability that they too are going to end up in a STEM sort of field. That's culture. That is the culture of the household. If your parents, you know, maybe never gave a shit about math, science, technology, and did something else, well, guess what? The kid probably isn't going to be in STEM when they grow up. Now, it's not a guarantee. I'm not saying this is 100% true. I'm just telling you the general case. So in soccer, it's the same thing, Ben. If you've never played soccer, if you've never really loved soccer, and it's not really in the household environment on the TV, you know, all the time, then, well, you don't have a soccer culture, and it's going to take your son or daughter to be a supreme unlikely outlier to break that culture and become an amazing soccer player, soccer person themselves.
Yeah. All right, Gary. I got to go work on my halftime speech in the mirror right now.
Cool, man. Cool, cool. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football, while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers, everyone, and keep building.